Democrats came out in big numbers for yesterday's spring election in Wisconsin, electing Milwaukee County Judge Rebecca Dallet to the state Supreme Court. She beat Sauk County Judge Michael Skrenik 56-44%. And by an even bigger margin, voters decided to keep the state treasurer's office intact. Had they gone the other way, the 170-year-old position would have been eliminated. The Supreme Court election got national attention. It's seen as another possible indication that there could be a blue wave in the fall midterms. Governor Scott Walker tweeted a warning last night that Democrats could be in a position to win big this November, and they're coming after him next, he says. Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us with more. Sean, welcome back.
Hey, Rob.
So how much can we read into a state Supreme Court spring election result?
It's always going to be debatable on a Supreme Court race because there aren't party labels attached to these candidates.
Or are there?
Yes, they're pretty much are. They're just not appearing on the ballot as a Republican or a Democrat. But everybody, I think, went into this race knowing that Rebecca Dallet was favored by Democrats because national Democrats came in and said so repeatedly. And in case there was any doubt that Michael Skrenik was favored by Republicans, the Republican Party spent heavily on his behalf, including running ads featuring Michael Skrenik and Governor Walker. So, I mean, that the partisanship was pretty well known. It is still a low turnout race, but I think there's a lot that you can read into this race because Democrats don't typically do well in these races, and they did especially well last night.
Right. It seems like it's a matter of which party can turn out voters, make the explanation of which one is their candidate, and then get people to realize that it's a serious election, go vote for it. And Republicans, as you say, have done pretty well with this, especially for open Supreme Court seats in the state.
You just look back at the last decade of Supreme Court races in Wisconsin, since they've been really heavily politicized and have become expensive affairs, and Republicans have won all the contested races. I mean, all the really competitive races. There have been some when Democrats have come close, but they've never gotten over that hump. And you now have a 5-2 majority on the court. Rebecca Dallet's win last night is going to trim that to 4-3.
I want to give a listen to Rebecca Dallet after winning by about 115,000 votes. Here's what she had to say last night at her victory party.
Tonight we proved that when the people rise up and stand together, we can beat the special interests. We beat the NRA. Of dollars that were spent on this race flooding into our state. And it's by taking these strong stands that we can restore the reputation and the independence of our judicial branch.
And that matches up with how she framed her campaign in many ways, standing up to the NRA. That was a theme, accusing Judge Skrenik of being a rubber stamp for Governor Walker if he was elected. Talk a little more about how she campaigned.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's noteworthy to look at what her supporters were saying after this race, because they have this victory in hand now, and it's kind of they're looking to frame this and move on to the next race in another state in another month. And they were really hitting on the fact that Rebecca Dallet ran against the NRA and that the NRA had backed Michael Skrenik in this race. And they're also hitting on the point that Governor Walker supported Skrenik, viewing that as some kind of a referendum on him. Whether or not that's the case, we're not going to know, but that's how they're billing this at this point.
And here's Judge Michael Skrenik in his concession talking to his supporters here.
I love my job, and I will be back on the bench tomorrow morning. And as I said before, there are lots of people, perhaps some in this room, but lots of people in this county who will at some level be pleased with these results as I get to continue to serve Sauk County as a circuit court judge, and I'm privileged to be able to do that.
So that's the race. Those are the candidates. And now everybody's digging through the maps and trying to figure out who voted for whom, where. And that's a lot of what the story is, Sean. Talk about what you're seeing.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of ways you could slice these numbers, but I think a few things stuck out to me just on first glance. One is that Rebecca Dallet won 24 counties that Hillary Clinton lost in 2016. Now, again, this is a different kind of election. More people vote in a presidential than in an April election, But that is a remarkable turnaround for Democrats in less than 2 years. And she won them across, you know, the throughout Wisconsin, really, and in important places for Democrats in southwest Wisconsin, a place that has a tendency still to swing in Wisconsin races, like Crawford County, is one that has gotten a lot of national attention as being a county that supported President Obama, supported President Trump, supported Rebecca Dallet last night. Also pretty noteworthy that Rebecca Dallet won Brown County and won it pretty convincingly, because Brown County, ever since President Obama won it back in 2008, Brown County has gone to, it's practically a Republican base county in elections since then. And last night, Rebecca Dallet won with 55% of the vote in Brown County. That's higher than President Obama got in 2008. So definitely noteworthy there.
Talking to WPR's Sean Johnson about yesterday's election results. It's a convincing margin. You see a lot of counties where if it's a Republican place, the Republican wins 60-some percent. That's pretty resounding. If Democrats win a county by 60-some percent, big deal. Dane County.
Yeah, Dane County. So we always know going into these races that Dane County is going to win big for the Democrat. And it's just a matter of how big. And the Supreme Court race kind of ratcheted that up more than we've seen in the past last night. So Rebecca Dallet won 81% of the vote in Dane County. That is big. Again, to compare that to President Obama's 2008 election. Remember, 2008 was a wave year for Democrats, a very good year for President Obama. He won about 73% of the vote in 2008. Rebecca Dallet got 81%. That, if you needed any evidence that Democrats are energized right now at this stage in the campaign cycle, I think that's pretty good evidence of it, that in a strong blue county like Dane County, they turned out to vote.
People are trying to slice and dice precincts now and see how they match up with congressional districts in Wisconsin. What are and this is still something that's ongoing right now, but based on what you've seen so far, Sean, what do you think?
Yeah, so Decision Desk HQ is somebody who does this quite a bit, and they sliced up, as you mentioned, the congressional districts. If the Supreme Court race were translated over to the congressional districts, what would it mean? And it would mean that Rebecca Dallet won four of the districts, and that Michael Scrinock won four. So four for Republicans, four for Democrats. But and so what would that mean? How would that translate to who's in Congress right now? Rebecca Dallet won Republican Mike Gallagher's congressional district, the 8th. And she came very close in Sean Duffy's 7th congressional district, too. So just to give you a little perspective on how this would translate to actual seats come November.
Well, we're going to keep chugging through these numbers and looking ahead to elections. I want to touch on this state treasurer vote referendum, basically. It would change the state's constitution, would have changed the state's constitution, but it was rejected by voters.
Yeah, this was interesting because you had this passed the legislature, two consecutive sessions of the legislature. It mostly on Republican support, but you got a handful of Democrats that helped put it on the ballot. This is something that way back when in 2010, Milwaukee Mayor Tom Barrett, when he was running for governor
as a Democrat,
he proposed eliminating the state treasurer. So it is a Republican idea more recently, but it hasn't always been that way. But in this Democratic, you know, certainly a Democratic election last night, where they were the ones going out to the polls, they were the ones electing Rebecca Dallet, they decided we're going to keep the treasurer. And, you know, it could be that people just love treasurers in Wisconsin. It could be that that idea got kind of attached to Governor Walker, that Republicans had put it on the ballot. It was viewed as kind of like an overreach by Republicans where they were trying to, you know, take more power over an executive office. And it was resoundingly, you know, the amendment was resoundingly defeated, 200,000 votes. People decided they were going to keep the treasurer, which still doesn't do too much.
Sean, we'll keep checking in with you on these stories. Thanks a lot for joining us.
You're welcome.
That's Sean Johnson, Wisconsin Public Radio State Capitol Bureau Chief. He joined us to recap yesterday's election results. While it seems the glory days of renting movies in a store is in the past, there are still some video stores out there. River West Film and Video in Milwaukee is one that's been around since 1998. They have videos for rent, film supplies for hobbyists and filmmakers, and they operate River West Radio from their storefront window. But apart from the business doings, there's a lot more going on. It's a community for creative people and ideas. Amir Chakarose is a documentary filmmaker living in Milwaukee. He teaches film production at Lake Forest College and the film department at UW-Milwaukee. His documentary about River West film and video will be featured at the Wisconsin Film Festival this week. Amir, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, Amir, what caught your eye about this River West video store and made you want to make a documentary about it?
Well, River West is the neighborhood of the video store, and I live in this neighborhood. And also, the owner of the video store, is a longtime friend, Xavier Lapierre. So I was already familiar with that space. And then I realized that something is going on there, something big. And I said, why am I not documenting that? So I started to film it in 2013, and then I kept filming until 2015, and I said, that's enough. Now I can make a film about it.
And people might hear a video store, something big is going on. So what is that something big?
Well, I just realized that there's a people circulation is going on there. Like, what I mean is people from like different social groups, like different communities are coming there, putting their voice out there. And I just realized that this is something like uncommon, you know, and I just said it should be documented.
Want to listen to a clip that you shared with us from the documentary.
For the most part, people don't do things unless they're getting paid, right? You know, it's about money. Like, okay, well, how much money did we bring in? Like, people here are doing a lot of things and putting a lot of heart and soul into things, and they're not getting paid. They're doing it because they enjoy, you know, the creative process. You know, they enjoy seeing not only them personally create things, but watching other people create things. So I think that's really what makes it important to me.
So explain that clip to us.
So this is one of the programmers, Ian Powell. He is just talking about his opinion about radio station and about the store, how it is helpful for him.
And talk about River West Film as a creative hub, a place for people to come together to be creative, as he was talking about there.
Yeah. So, yeah, they have a chance to design their own program. And, you know, right now, when I start to make this film, it was a, like, internet-based radio station, but they get their community radio license. Like, right now, they have an FM license. Because of this, they have more regulations, so... How can I say? I think they can choose what they can do. They don't have that much limitation about their creation. So this is what I can say.
So that's the radio side of River West. And talk about the old-fashioned video rental aspect of it. Do they have kind of a special collection that we might not have seen elsewhere?
Of course, yeah. There are very different type of collections. You're right. Yesterday, I just checked out Lars von Trier films, The Idiots. You cannot even find a copy, DVD copy, in the United States, like a kind of region-free copy. So, yes, there are like unusual films there you can check out.
And I understand this isn't just a place where people get movies to watch. It's also a place where people who want to make movies for fun or more seriously connect and actually get some of their gear.
So, yes, this store also sells some film equipment. So it's a good source for like local filmmakers who are familiar with filmmaking in Milwaukee should know this space.
Can you talk about some of the other key characters who appear in your documentary?
Well, I have like 4 or 5 main characters, and then also like maybe 10 or 15 like side characters, I would name them. So Xavier Lapierre, who is the owner of the radio station, and Rabbi Bradley, he's selling flour all around the city. And Paul Finger, he's a kind of one of the regular of the radio station. And Ian Powell, just you listen to his clip, he's a programmer, and also he lives in the neighborhood. And also one more person, I would say Georgie, he's also part of the community.
And I understand, as a documentary filmmaker, you like to put yourself not just behind the camera, but you have yourself out there in front too, and kind of exposed a little bit that documentary filmmakers aren't always.
Yeah, just that's kind of my I would say, my style, my approach to filmmaking, because I feel like it is much more accessible, like this, accessible to my subjects. Like if you just if you just observe what's going on there, I don't think that you get enough information. But when you pass in front of the camera, you start to part of what's going on. You can ask questions. So it makes me get more information about my subjects.
And talk about this space. You know, a lot of times people might just come in and out of a store and not think much about it. What did you learn from, you know, spending, like as you said, a couple of years filming this and really focusing in on this this community hub?
Well, I will say that never judge a book by its cover. From outside, it looks like a small store, but inside, it's that there's a huge, big world, like a different world there. You know, like, as I told you, like people coming from different places in Milwaukee, different social groups, like they are just expressing themselves there. It's much more than a video store and or a kind of radio station.
So, Amir, this is showing at the Wisconsin Film Festival. What do you have another project in the works now?
Well, that's actually just finished this like two weeks ago, and yes, I have some ideas, but nothing going on right now.
All right, Amir, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Rob.
We've been talking to Amir Chakarose, a documentary filmmaker. He's based in Milwaukee. He teaches film production there at Lake Forest College and the film department of UW-Milwaukee. His documentary about River West Film and Video will be featured in the Wisconsin Film Fest this week. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on the morning show, Kate Archer Kent talks to the author of a new book, Semitism, Being Jewish in America in the Age of Trump. Now, as Americans, our identities are often defined by our careers. But what if we were also defined by our hobbies, the things we did outside of work just for fun? Our next guest says that could make us a lot happier. And we want to hear from you. Has taking up a hobby improved your life? Do you think that a strong career identity has helped or hurt you in the long run? What kinds of hobbies are best for happiness? Tweet us at CentralTimeWPR and let us know. Susie Nielsen is a writer whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Vice, and Quartz. She recently wrote about hobbies for TheCut.com. Susie, thanks for joining us today.
Rob, thank you so much for having me.
You write, Susie, that over half of us Americans get our sense of identity, at least in a big part, from our jobs. Is that saying something about us as Americans and where our preoccupations are?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about this because, you know, I'm a journalist and I run with a crowd that's pretty work obsessed. I also went to kind of a university that stressed that, and I just think we get that kind of messaging a lot. In the piece I wrote about this advertisement that displays a woman who sort of looks super sleep deprived, and it's an advertisement for a sort of gig economy kind of job. The woman's expected to work around the clock, and the advertisement glorifies that. And I think that's a problem we kind of all have. We push each other to work as much as possible.
And you write that you were at a gathering and somebody asked, what do you do? And you gave the wrong answer, basically.
Yeah, it's so funny. I mean, it was kind of a culture shock. So I was in South Africa last year filming a documentary, and I went to this barbecue dinner with a couple of friends, and a South African woman asked me, what do you do? And I thought she meant, what do you do for work? Because that's kind of the knee-jerk response that every American has to that question. So I told her, you know, I'm a journalist, I work for a magazine, and she kind of looked at me with amusement, almost. It was kind of a shock, you know. I just assumed that that's how everyone answered that question, but I've since found, you know, I've been thinking back on it, and even when I've been in places like Spain or Australia, people have asked me that question, and it doesn't usually refer to, what is your job, which tends to be the more boring answer. In other countries, people are really asking, what do you like to do? What sort of stokes your fire, or what do you find interesting? And usually when you answer in that way, it actually leads to a more interesting conversation and can often build a better relationship. So I just thought that was really interesting.
And I think we view the hobby that we have, whatever it might be, as maybe something kind of frivolous, maybe kind of goofy that we spend our time doing this. But you, right, you looked at some research and some expertise on this. Having that hobby or those hobbies, it can be serious stuff. It can have real benefits for us.
Yeah, you know, so I was really interested in the sort of psychology behind this. So I found this study by a Duke University professor, Patricia Linville, and she was looking at how different people react to stressors in their lives. And one example she gave was of somebody who identified themselves primarily through their work and their marriage. And say that person suffers a professional setback due to maybe a marital complication. If that person identifies just as a partner and just as a professional, then their what's called their self-concept is going to kind of take a much bigger blow than say if they identify themselves in a number of different lights. Like, I've been trying to do this more because I definitely can fall into this trap. But I've been trying to think of myself, you know, I'm not just a writer, I'm also a singer. I like to sing. I like to go swimming. I'm also a sister and a daughter. And the more, the argument basically is that the more different kind of identity baskets you have, the less likely it is that one really big blow is going to knock you out.
And Susie, you mentioned that you've got a job that takes up a lot of your time and attention. Do you feel like you have time to do things like your singing or other hobbies?
Well, it's funny you ask that because I just reconnected with my old college band.
Wow.
Yeah, Juicy Fruit. I'm very excited. We're hopefully going to start rehearsing pretty soon. But I would say I'm actually in graduate school right now, and that can kind of be a draw on your time. But I find that even if I don't have time for, you know, a scheduled hobby, like twice or three times a week, taking up a few hours, just going for walks with friends or really putting some time into your relationships can really help with this. Because the more relationships you have, you have those sort of different selves when you're interacting with different people. And then even something as simple as like an exercise class that is fun and kind of gets you moving and meeting other people. I think we can all do it, you know. Everyone says, you know, I don't have time for this, but it's really about what you make time for. So if you really care about, you know, having a stable mental state, which I know, I mean, a lot of my peers actually kind of glorify this up and down way of living, but if you want to sort of take steps towards safeguarding your mental health, definitely reach out to more people and take some time to diversify your interests.
We're talking about hobbies and the value of having a hobby. Susie Nielsen is with us. She's written about this recently. We'll go to your calls now. Our listeners have hobbies, apparently, and want to share them with us. John starts us off in Nina. John, hi.
Hey, how are you doing?
Good. What's your hobby, John?
My hobby is building drones, quadcopters and hexacopters. I'm 54 years old, and I found this hobby a couple of years ago. Looking at YouTubes, I bought one of the little tiny plastic toys, and it just has snowballed since then.
Were you mechanically inclined before this, John?
I'm an electrical engineer by training. and there's all sorts of YouTube videos, and there's all sorts of communities out there. I've got my favorite people I like to follow, and there's a lot of soldering, firmware upgrades. I mean, at the end of the day, you get a camera up in the air. It's really a fun hobby.
And, John, do you have friends from this online and or in person?
Well, mostly online. The folks I work with, they don't get into the hobby. My kids, they can't stand going out with me to the field because, you know, one of the things in the hobby is you wreck the thing, right? And then you spend most of your time rebuilding it.
John, that sounds like a lot of fun. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And Susie, he started this, I mean, he had relevant experience as an electrical engineer, but he started this in his 50s, so we can discover these new hobbies whenever in our lives, really.
Yeah, that's really great. I actually, that reminds me of my uncle, actually, who lives in the Bay Area. He's recently started taking up woodworking, and he makes these amazing bowls, but he was not really artistically inclined before this. He started in his late 40s, and now he's selling them. So I think it's definitely possible to take up hobbies later in life, even if it's not really in your field of expertise, but probably that helps.
John, thanks a lot for calling. We'll go next to Logan in Wisconsin Dells. Logan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What's your hobby, Logan?
Well, when I was a kid, I grew up in Appalachia, and our parents had a showing rabbit, like dog shows with rabbits. And we went all over the country from Rhode Island to Wichita, Kansas, to these national rabbit shows where there'd be 20,000 rabbits.
Wow.
And it completely changed my life as a kid. Coming from Appalachia, I was exposed to all different kinds of ways of living, and everybody from city slickers to farmers who spoke four languages, and just completely shaped my entire worldview, you know, that I grew into just from showing rabbits as a kid to being exposed to different people.
Do you still raise rabbits, Logan, or do you have new hobbies nowadays?
I don't raise rabbits anymore. I moved to Wisconsin a few years ago. I was supposed to be here for 3 months. Now I'm going on year four. And so I've been talking about going out and getting some rabbits, and there's a trio of American sable rabbits. It's this beautiful breed in Tennessee for $500 for the three of them. And I keep thinking, am I crazy enough to get back into this and drop $500 on three rabbits, drive down to Tennessee and pick them up? And I think I just might be.
All right, get back in the game, Logan. Thanks. And you can, of course, check out rabbits at all the county fairs, and especially the big state fair in the summer. There are a lot of people showing rabbits there. So, Susie, Logan is maybe on the cusp of getting back into his childhood hobby.
Oh, man, I hope so. That sounds like an incredible hobby. I'm a little jealous.
Susie Nielsen is with us to talk about her latest piece for The Cut, Why Hobbies Make You Happy. And we want to hear from you. Is your identity wrapped up in your work? Do you have a hobby that makes you happy that you consider an important part of who you are? You can tweet us about that at Central Time WPR. We're talking about the link between hobbies and happiness with Susie Nielsen. She's a writer whose work has appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, Vice, and Quartz. She wrote a piece recently about hobbies at thecut.com. What about you? What is your favorite hobby? Has it made a difference in your life? Do you think identifying with your work is maybe not so bad? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you're thinking about hobbies. Carrie is on the line in Milwaukee. Carrie, hi.
Hi. I have too many hobbies to even list or have time for. I refer to myself as a voracious reader, an avid angler, a lover of all crafts, and last year I got back into woodworking.
Wow.
Building things. And I can attest to what you're talking about. I've been through, the last 6 years have been a very up and down period for me career-wise, but I've never completely lost my mind because I've always had something to do while I was looking for a job. You know what I mean? On the other hand, my husband has a job loss a few years ago, and he fell into a severe depression, like debilitating, for about 2 years. And, you know, I think we as a society, men are far more likely to identify themselves by their career and what their job title is. And it literally took away his sense of self, as you were discussing earlier. I know that if I'm out of work or something, I've always got something to fall back on. I mean, gosh, I can hopefully fill the freezer with fish if I need to. So it's a huge thing for me, and I'm really glad to see that there's some research around it, and I'm not just speaking anecdotally.
Thank you so much for sharing that, and good luck to your husband. I hope things have bounced back there. Susie, that really gets to a lot of what you're talking about. If we're too much bound into our job as our identity, I mean, job loss is bad enough economically, forget the identity part, but if it's our identity too, that's a really big loss.
Yeah, it actually made me think about, you know, a lot of different sectors of the American economy are being turned over to AI, like, you know, a lot of these self-driving cars, and the Amazon Go store just opened up in Seattle, and that will sort of, if that store model replicates, a lot of retail jobs will be gone. And I just keep thinking about how many people will have so much free time on their hands. And I mean, barring the economic difficulties, the mental health stuff can actually make it a lot harder to look for a job. So that point is really important, I think, to keep yourself busy if you have all that time.
Thanks a lot for calling in. We'll go next to Paula on the line in Cambridge. Paula, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about, Paula?
Well, I, at age 47, realized a lifelong dream, and my primary hobby has been working with, I purchased an off-track thoroughbred.
Wow.
And with a lot of support, have trained her, and I'm still training her, but I've had her for almost 4 years now, and it makes me so happy and is so fulfilling, and I love her beyond reason.
Oh. And Paula, did you have horses around when you were a kid, or were you the kid who's like, I want a horse, but I get one someday, I'm going to get a horse?
No, I had worked at a stable and okay. I had riding lessons, but I had never owned a horse. I begged for one and never got one. So this is the first horse I ever owned. But it has just, and you know, it's become a huge part of my social network. I share it with some of the younger females in the family. I ride with my great niece. And it's when I'm stressed, I go to the stable. and I have a very rewarding job. I enjoy what I do, but there's just not been anything else in my life quite like this.
Paula, thank you so much for sharing that. Wow, so much there, Susie. Her social network, it brings her together with family members, it sounds like, and stress relief, plus fulfilling that lifelong dream all in one.
Yeah, what struck me actually is I'm starting to see a pattern here of people using hobbies to connect with their childhood selves, which I think really is an interesting layer to this whole self-complexity thing because, you know, work is this very grown-up thing. We become adults and we get all these responsibilities, but in doing that, we often lose kind of the sense of wonder and lightness of being a kid. And if you can have a hobby that connects you back with that, that's really amazing. I mean, that's how I treat singing, actually, because I was singing since I was 3. Like, I was in musical theater and I did all that. So I resonate with that impulse, I guess.
That's interesting. Hobbies are often the things we give up to become adults.
Yeah.
Which is sad but happy when we come back. Yeah. Paula, thank you so much. I'll go next to Mike on the line in Appleton. Mike, hi.
Hey, it's good to talk to you. So I have more hobbies than you can name, but I started playing the 5-string banjo when I was probably 14 or 15, and I'm 62 right now. And I worked my way through school, playing in bands and everything. Well, the long and the short of it is when I retired, I was finally able to play the banjo just because it sounds so beautiful, and I've grown just to love it, and I literally could play 4 or 5 hours a day and not even think about it. Then I draw, pen and ink and pencils, and I walk all over the woods, and the best thing about being retired is living in Appleton, I'm an hour and a half away from Door County, so I get to Door County about once a month, and it's just adventuring and new experiences and new feelings and a sense of mindfulness. And when I play the banjo, especially, I'm in a different state, and it's not about making money anymore. It's about the love of the sound.
Fantastic, Mike. Thank you so much. And Susie, a lot there, but he's retired now, and that makes me think, you know, we talked about job loss, but you hear people sometimes they're at loose ends after they retire, especially if work was everything that life was built around. That's going to be a critical time, I would imagine, to find a good hobby.
Definitely, yeah. Actually, that makes me think about, so my stepdad actually retired a few years ago, and he's the kind of person that can't really be sitting around doing nothing. Like, he's kind of a compulsive doer, and this is less of a hobby and more of a really big project, but last summer he decided he was going to bike across the U.S.
Wow.
He made it 4,000 miles over 3 months, I think, and it was so fun. I joined him on a leg or two of it, and it was so fun to watch how he, he was just over the course of the trip, he started relating to the world so differently, and I think that touches on what you were just speaking about, with the sort of, I feel like the more multi-sensory your hobbies can be, like playing music or going on an adventure, sort of broadening yourself out beyond, you know, your office or like the screen of a computer, which is often, I mean, that's a lot of the jobs we have today.
Mike, thank you so much for talking about hobbies with writer Susie Nielsen. Back to your calls. Ashley is on the line in Madison. Ashley, hi.
Hi. So I was calling because I am a mother of a two-year-old and twin seven-month-olds. And with this second pregnancy, I've had been affected by postpartum depression and anxiety. And something that my therapist and my doctor said was that I needed to get back in touch with me, find an identity outside of being, you know, my job and being a mother. And so I've started taking Tai Chi classes through the City Rec program, and something as simple as taking 30 minutes a couple times a week to close the bedroom door and read a book of my choosing without having to think about anything but myself. And I have found that has been very rewarding and rejuvenating for me as I work through the postpartum depression and anxiety.
Ashley, I'm so glad you found those hobbies to help you through that. Susie, finding space for herself. I mean, that's a lot of what people are doing, I guess, with hobbies.
Yeah, definitely. And I think something like reading, which can sort of transport you into a different world where you don't have all those responsibilities, because that's what work is. It's being responsible for often a lot of different people and a lot of different tasks. And a hobby that can sort of just take you out of that universe can be so, so helpful.
Ashley, thanks for that call. In our last minute or so, Susie, we were talking earlier around the office today. Maybe hobby, it sounds like a trivial word. Do we need a better word?
I think so. I think even the word hobby, it sounds so sing-song, you know? Like, I just kept thinking in this article when people asked me about it, I would say, you know, I wouldn't say I was writing about hobbies. I would say I was writing about self-complexity, because I think that's really what it is. It doesn't have to be, like I said, a scheduled activity, and it doesn't have to be like wood carving, although that's a really cool one. But as long as you're kind of taking the time to check in with yourself in a way that's not like a productivity machine, I think that's what's really important, to just really remember that you're not living to work. You have a life outside of that.
Yeah, people we won't have time to get to. We've got Kelly on the line who paints, Emily who is a Lego builder, Andy emailed. He builds and customizes motorcycles, and we a lot of people out there with things. Are you inspired, Susie, to make sure you make time to hang out with the band and do some singing?
Oh, definitely. I'm going to do that this weekend. I'm going to text my friend Austin as soon as I get off the phone with you.
Fantastic. Susie, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you so much, Rob. It was a pleasure.
That was Susie Nielsen. She joined us to talk about a recent piece for The Cut, Why Hobbies Make You Happy. You can keep the conversation going on Twitter. What is your hobby? What does it add to your life? Let us know. Tweet us at Central Time WPR.